This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
We're making unforced errors, and we shouldn't. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about what's going on with men globally. What's this blue slip stuff Trump is so angry about? Katie Zachariah joins us. All that and more coming up on Umrah. All right. So in a few minutes, we're going to interview Katie Zachariah. And I'll tell you right now, she's pretty somber on how we're looking for the midterms and potentially 2028. So whether or not that happens, we have to assume we're approaching a time where we might lose power in Washington, D.C. We know how evil the communists are. We remember it wasn't ancient history. We remember how they operated under Joe Biden, arresting, murdering their political opponents. Everything had to be gay. It was just the worst friggin' thing in the world. And we know, you know, I know, they'll do worse next time. They're not sorry. They're not regretful. They think they didn't bring in enough illegals last time. So that's what we're facing if the communists come back to power. So what I'm about to say, I want you to know that's where I'm coming from when I say what I'm about to say. We have to operate with a level of seriousness and viciousness. We have to be intelligent with how we're fighting right now. We can't afford mistakes. There was a story yesterday. I'm just going to touch on it just for a minute. Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair, communist magazine. Vanity Fair puts out a nasty hit piece on Susie Wiles, White House chief of staff. It's not just a hit piece on Susie Wiles. They stooped so low as to find the worst picture of Caroline Leavitt ever and published it. I mean, they just did everybody dirty in the whole thing. Okay. They're communists. That's what they do. Susie Wiles sat down with Vanity Fair for 11 straight days. 11 days? We gave 11 days to Vanity Fair, giving them all the ammunition they need to create a 24-hour news cycle. Of course, taking words out of context, and this, of course they did, of course they would, lying about everything. This is unacceptable. We don't have time for this. The urgency needs to be there. We don't have time for Washington people to fall in love with the thought of maybe getting a lovely article in the New York Times or Vanity Fair about themselves. And that's exactly what happens. They get out on the campaign trail and they talk to you and they talk to me and they're going to fight the system and they're going to drain the swamp and they're going to do all these things. And then they get to Washington, D.C. and they just can't help themselves. The siren song of maybe getting a nice piece in Vanity Fair you can show your mother is too much. And soon, we're getting blasted for it. It's not the end of the world. It's yesterday's news. It's not the end of the world. But it is indicative that maybe we're not operating with the level of seriousness and urgency we should. When the communists come back to power, they're going to do everything they can to make sure we never have another shot at it. That's how nasty and demonic these people are. You think they arrested a lot of Republicans last time? I think they destroyed a lot of people in the Trump administration last time, including attempts to destroy Trump himself. Last time was the appetizer. Last time was the Cheddar Bay biscuits before Red Lobster brings you the main course. We have to be better. We have to be sharper. This is not good enough. White House, I hope you're listening. That may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Katie Zachariah has got some sobering analysis about how we're looking in the midterms, 2028, what's happening with this blue slip stuff. She joins us in just a moment. Before she joins us, we also have Charles Cornish Dale coming up in the show, later on in the show. And one of the things he's hot on is testosterone. I know it's one of those uncomfortable topics. We've lost 50% of our testosterone in 50 years. Western civilization, the United States of America, has. It's going down more every year. We drink estrogen. It's in the waters. We can't survive like this. We don't want to go jam needles into our arm. Natural herbal supplements from Chalk. Clinically tested. 20% increase in your testosterone in 90 days. 2026 for you is about to be a year full of energy, focus. Your mind's going to work better. Go to chalk.com/JesseTV. Get a subscription 3 months away from feeling like a new person. We'll be back.
As for the Vanity Fair article, Michael, I'll take your question directly. This is, unfortunately, another example of disingenuous reporting, where you have a reporter who took the chief of staff's words wildly out of context, did not include the context those conversations were had within. And then further, I think the most egregious part of this article was the bias of omission that was clearly present. And we see a lot of this when dealing with the media every day. You will leave out important context, leave out comments and facts. You know, many people in this building spoke with that reporter, and those comments were never included in the story, probably because it didn't push this false narrative of chaos and confusion that the reporter was clearly trying to push.
Joining me now, Katie Zachariah, legal and political strategist. Katie, I think very highly of Caroline Levitt. I think she's super sharp, thinks she's excellent at her job. She deals with the media every day. Susie Wiles deals with the media every single day. How can you be so dumb to sit down with them for 11 days and think you're going to get any other result than the one you got? That's my problem with the whole thing.
I agree with you. I love President Trump on the campaign trail. He used this poem called The Snake. And it was used in the context of immigration and illegal immigration, where this woman lets in this snake from the cold and she warms it up. And eventually the snake bites her and kills her. But why is this the biggest analogy in my mind to an interview, 11 interviews with Vanity Fair? They have basically decided to deny what a snake is and invite the snake into their home, the White House, and expect the snake to not have snake-like traits, to not turn around and bite them when it is beneficial. So I'm completely with you. I think they might have set out with the right intent that they wanted to present a nicer, more beautiful look of the White House, but they're dealing with a snake. That's always going to be a snake. And eventually, what does the snake say at the end of President Trump's poem? "Oh, shut up, silly woman," said the reptile with a grin. "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." And in my mind, this is the exact equivalent of Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair, for the last 10 or 11 or 12 years, has done nothing but hit pieces and been vile to President Trump. Why in 2025 are we thinking that this is any different, Jesse?
I don't know. By the way, my wife would 100% take a snake in. I know she would. She'd be like, "It's sick," or something. I know she would do that. All right. It's part of the problem, Katie, that even if you have the right intention, you get to D.C., whether you're a senator in the White House, you still want that puff piece in the New York Times. You can't help yourself. You want CBS to give you a glowing profile. You want Vanity Fair to make your eyes look pretty. It's just, it's like they can't, it's like the sirens. They can't stay away from them.
Right. I think it's exactly what you're saying. People are drawn to this. Except when you're outside of DC, it's so easy to look at Vanity Fair, Vogue, all these different journals and different newspapers and see for what it is. But then you get there and they lure this bright, shiny object in front of you. We want to do a nice puff piece. We want to look, make you look good, but they're never going to change. They're never going to change. And this is part of the problem. Is it the chicken or the egg? Are they feeding off of people's egos to continue making them look good and bolster them in the media? What if all this went away? What if we just focused on, it doesn't even have to be all right-wing media, but fair and balanced media, media that's somewhat center, taking kind of this middle of the road. No, they still go to the far left, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and they want this nice article. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen until you get rid of the leadership at these different journals. Washington Post, for instance, these types of hit pieces are forevermore going to occur until they decide to get rid of all of the people running it, Jesse.
Katie, the stakes are obviously high. Everyone remembers how the communists operated under Joe Biden for 4 years. And for them, that was just wetting their whistle. That was just an appetizer. What's going to happen if we lose the House of Representatives at the midterms?
I've been so, so clear on this, Jesse. We will lose. I'll go on the long game. We will lose the 28th presidential. The Republicans, it is my opinion that if we do not keep the House, President Trump will be suffering under all of the Hakeem Jeffries impeachment inquiries, and we will be on the complete defense for the final 2 years of President Trump's term. We will get nothing done, nothing accomplished. We're already not getting anything accomplished in my mind. There is so much the House and Senate could be doing. There is so much that they could be implementing, and they are just slow rolling every single thing. So what happens when the Democrats regain majority? Nancy Pelosi was just on an interview with USA Today, and she was asked, are you confident that that the Democrats will be able to take the majority? And she said, I'm not confident. I am sure of it. I am sure we're going to take it. It's only 3 seats that's necessary. And while she's a little bit senile in these days, I actually agree, unless the Republicans really change the trajectory and what they're doing, the Miami mayoral race was the bellwether for me, that the Republican, we lost a stronghold, a Republican stronghold, where a Republican was mayor for 30 years. While it's a nonpartisan office, we all know it is, and we lost to a Democrat. And I think this is a key indication that this was the Republican that lost was Trump-backed, and we still lost it in Florida, of all places. And so if the Republicans don't get serious, and I mean extremely serious, about healthcare overhaul, Speaker Johnson just said he was going to implement all of the president's or many of the president's executive orders. Why are we waiting so long to do all of this, Jesse? We have a very short amount of time to start accomplishing all this. And it just seems like they're dragging their feet and resisting the president at every step of the way. So what happens in 26? I don't think it's looking good for the Republicans right now. I really don't. And then long game, it doesn't look good for 28 presidential.
Katie, I know it seems nonsensical, but do Republicans want to be in the minority? Then you don't have to actually do anything. You don't have to have any courage at all. You can just sit there and whine and complain and send out fundraising texts to you and me. Send me $20. But I feel like they want to be in the minority.
It feels that way. It feels we have this golden opportunity, right? We worked so hard. I worked so hard, and they worked so hard, allegedly, to get President Trump back in office after 4 years of the disaster of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And we beat Kamala, and we beat her really well. However, we're not taking advantage of this time that we have in office. So do Republicans want to be in the minority? You make a great point. They're not fighting like they want to be in the majority. What does that look like? I know that nuking the filibuster can be controversial. It has its downsides. It has its upsides. If the Democrats were in power and they knew that 26 midterms were looming and they were going to likely lose, and then that then had an indication that they would likely lose the presidency, they would be doing everything in their power to be ramming through their agenda. And yet Republicans want to talk about blue slip courtesy and not nuking the filibuster because it could come back and haunt us. Jesse, if they don't pass voter ID, proof of citizenship under the SAVE Act, Republicans will likely not win for a very long time if we don't have a regulation on our election. So I don't know why they want to be so weak in the knee. I honestly don't.
Katie, what is this blue slip stuff? Can you explain it to stupid people like me? Because Trump is super hot on it, and he's angry with Republicans about it. What does this mean?
So the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is led by Chuck Grassley right now, is it, the blue slip existed about since 1917. And what it is it gives the home state senators. So let's use Alina Habba's case, for example. So President Trump nominated his former attorney, Alina Habba, to be the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. And what is the blue slip? So the blue slip gives Andy Kim and Cory Booker, the two home senators from New Jersey, the ability to basically say, we don't want Alina to be in office, and submit that to Chuck Grassley. And then Alina Habba does not get an opportunity to even go through a full Senate hearing, a full Senate committee hearing and nomination process. She just gets overridden by the two home state senators. And again, this is not codified in any senatorial rules. There is no framework for this except tradition and policy. And it existed at a time when where partisan politics, even 20 years ago, were not so hell-bent on blocking anything against President Trump did, or a Republican or Democrat did. They could actually maybe get through some Republicans in a blue state or Democrats in a red state. But we don't live in that time anymore, Jesse, where in California, you're going to have these Adam Schiff override a U.S. attorney appointment by President Trump or Cory Booker for Alina Habba. And so it's outdated. In my mind, you look at two different processes. You look at U.S. attorneys, which kind of fall under the DOJ and the president's executive authority and his Article II powers. And then you look at the judges, that right now it's just specifically district court judges. Actually, Grassley kind of moved it over to circuit court judges, where you could go through a full confirmation process and not the blue slips, but district court judges still go under the blue slip process. And I look at the infringement on his ability to actually execute criminal justice proceedings, which is under his Article II powers and under the DOJ. And we have two active grand jury indictments for Comey and Letitia James sitting in Virginia, and a U.S. attorney that they will not approve, that the two home senators in Virginia have said, we're not going to approve Lindsey Halligan. And so we can't actually execute on these two standing grand jury indictments because we don't have a prosecutor. So they're using this tradition to block the president's ability to execute on criminal justice reform, criminal justice and prosecutorial duties, which is an extension of his executive power. So whether it can build to this, does he have a viable case or a viable lawsuit? All I will say is it infringes on his Article II powers for appointments and then execution powers on prosecutions. And that is a dangerous place when we have people like Comey and James that need to be held accountable, Jesse.
Gosh, we are so freaking screwed. Katie, you have a Merry Christmas, all right? Gosh. All right, pick your chin up. We'll keep on marching here. Look, at least my gut feels good. I have colostrum in it. It's actually in there right now. Did you know that? You know why I have colostrum in there? Because I use cowboy colostrum. I put it in my coffee every single morning. Every morning. Mine's chocolate, so I have a chocolate cup of coffee every morning. But we're not talking about bad for you chocolate. We're talking about the kind of chocolate that makes your digestive system work the way it's supposed to work. Are there things that kind of upset your tummy? Worry about that when you wake up in the morning, going to bed at night. Why don't you try some cowboy colostrum in your life? You might just get the relief you're looking for. It was recommended to me by my sister, and man, it works. Cowboycolostrum.com. Use the code JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, well, I keep saying this because it seems like we're almost ready to go to war with Venezuela, but we're almost ready to go to war with Venezuela, I think. I don't know. Trump puts out a statement, says the Maduro regime needs to return. I want to make sure I read this right. Oil, land, or any other assets. And he's designated the regime as a foreign terrorist organization. What does all this mean? Where are we going? Let's talk to Joshua Phillip about this, host of Crossroads with Joshua Phillip. All right. Joshua, what's happening? What other assets? What's he talking about?
So I saw Trump's tweet. So a few areas to this. Everybody thought it was just about the drug boats, right? Trump's down there blowing up the drug boats, saying it's Tren de Aragua and the Cartel de Sons, which is the Venezuelan government, and Maduro being involved in the drug trade. And now he's talking about oil and land, and everyone's saying, hey, here we go, another oil war, you know? But what I assume this is about is Guyana, just north of Venezuela. And it's actually something I've been talking about kind of from the get-go, because to me, this has never been really just about drugs. This has been about restoring the Pax Americana, restoring the Monroe Doctrine, and also about preventing a war, which Venezuela and Brazil were just about to start literally a few months before they started blowing up the drug boats. So again, the main point here is Guyana, little tiny country just north of Venezuela, where they discovered several years back one of the world's largest oil reserves, and where you have Exxon and the United States having a heavy presence doing an oil exploration and oil drilling. And notably, when Venezuela cleared in its law to actually seize part of that country, because they claim they have partial ownership of it, they moved their military to the border, they were doing military drills, they moved their navy right there, right next to the Exxon Mobil, you know, oil platforms, and that's when Trump started this whole thing. So I assume that's what he's referring to.
Okay. They never moved on Guyana. Let's talk about this blockade we have going down there. Those things are only as successful as, you know, as you can trade with other countries in your area if you can't put anything on a ship. How many allies do they have around them?
So Venezuela is close allies with Cuba. In fact, under Chavez, Chavez and Fidel Castro were big buddies. And basically, they were one of the main areas that brought back the Cuban economy for a bit. They do trade pretty heavily with Brazil, pretty heavily with Colombia, but not enough to really support their economy. The sanctions have hit the main area of the Venezuelan economy, which is oil. It's basically oil and drugs, and that's almost about it. The sanctions cut off the oil. They still trade with Iran, still trade with China really heavily. And effectively, they've been using what are called black ships. Ships go in the area, turn off their beacons, go dark, get the oil, trade it, and that's how they've been avoiding sanctions.
Okay, so if we start to strangle that, and apparently we are going to start to strangle that, is this a country that's going to collapse? I mean, from what I understand, the people are already starving. What's it like there?
So this is the important context. A lot of this, I would say, goes back to 2018. The Venezuelan elections took place. Maduro, right, he was accused of rigging the elections. Trump's first term in office, mass protests in Venezuela. People were rioting on the streets saying Maduro stole the election. And actually, even the Biden administration also upheld that Maduro stole the election. So that's how bipartisan this was. Trump was talking about sending U.S. military assets to Venezuela to effectively, you know, help with regime change, to put down the Maduro regime because they were persecuting their own citizens. What happened was that Maduro actually called out to China and Russia and Iran for help. Russia sent two nuclear bombers to Venezuela and then sent a message to the United States saying if America intervenes, it'll be catastrophic. Effectively giving veiled nuclear threats, and also said if America intervenes, there's going to be bloodshed. And then China, the Chinese regime, they went to the United Nations and framed the United States as being a colonial power and pushing this colonial idea, which again, they're talking about the Monroe Doctrine, trying to control other states, and Trump actually backed off. But the country has never been stable. After Russia and China stepped in to keep Maduro in power, Maduro was actually using various cartels as the kind of foot soldiers to stay in power. They were kicking in doors, shooting people point blank, arresting people, I mean, the whole nine yards. And life for the average Venezuelan has gone down since then. So it's gotten worse, not better. And effectively, the only reason the regime is still there is because basically support from Russia and China. When Trump said he's going to make regime change this time, Maduro did the same thing. Russia, China, Iran, he sent out calls. There were open reports on it, and they're not coming to help him. Trump has China, you know, held pretty heavy economically right now. They're not going to risk ruining their economy Russia's not going to come to the rescue. They can barely survive in the war they're in right now, let alone support a second war. So Russia actually called on Russian citizens to leave. And Iran is not in a powerful position either, especially not after, you know, the bombings of their nuclear facilities and, you know, the back and forth they've had with Israel. None of the countries that would rescue them are capable of it right now.
So he's fresh out of friends. All right, let's talk a little cartel stuff, because the government essentially is a cartel there, and we have Mexican cartels, and the Trump administration is very loud about the fact they've declared war on these cartels. What effect has it had on them?
So this is something important. So when Trump was running for office, and, you know, he's done it since then, one of his campaign talking points was he's going to use the full military intelligence, special forces raids, naval blockades, the whole nine yards, to fight and destroy the cartels. He also said something very interesting, though. Trump said that if any country or any leader tries to stop him from doing that, he will expose the ties or connections of that leader to the cartels. And he's done that, right? They've declared that Maduro is the leader of the Cartel of the Suns, as are the heads of many of the people in his regime. They've declared that, the president in Colombia is also tied in with the cartels because he tried defending Maduro and tried to stop Trump from acting there. He's even levying similar kind of veiled threats to Mexico right now. So this ties into something bigger in how we understand drugs. Drugs are not just about money. Drugs are a tool to kind of create puppet states. So the drug trade, a lot of it in Latin America, was actually started up through a program between the Chinese Communist Party and Cuba. This goes back to when Fidel Castro was still in power and back when Mao Zedong was still head of the CCP. Mao Zedong came up with a drug warfare plan, which is actually publicly listed in their unrestricted warfare doctrine, using effectively Cuban intelligence networks to establish drug trade networks, training narco-terrorist organizations in China. They're basically Maoist communist groups, and then using those to spread corruption, using drugs, then using the money from drugs to push political campaigns, and then using criminality to effectively kill the opposition of the political campaigns, planting various leaders in power throughout the entire region, and then using those leaders to clear the way even more so for the drug trade, more money, more political money, more campaign money, and of course, more influence to buy people off, corrupt people, compromise people, kill off opponents, and effectively seize control of the region. This was the method used of using criminality to effectively take over most of Latin America. The Chinese Communist Party in Cuba were deeply involved with it, as was Hugo Chavez. And so as it relates now to Maduro being the leader of the Cartel of the Suns, that's why. Effectively, drugs have been a tool to manufacture puppet states and get leaders in place tied in with it.
Joshua, what exactly were we doing when Mao Zedong was taking over the continent that's just south of us?
Well, you know, we had the war on drugs, and America was, of course, fighting, you know, Contra battles. I don't think America properly fought it, though, really. To an extent, we did maintain the Monroe Doctrine, you know, mid-early 1800s policy, no European colonies in Latin America, all of the Americas is our backyard, nobody outside of it. And so that kept out, of course, European colonies in the 1800s. Moving into the Cold War, it kept out the Soviets, kept out the Chinese. But we actually began losing that battle around the time of Hugo Chavez. So Hugo Chavez working together openly with Fidel Castro, again, back to this entire network they did, they made various inter-regional unions. So unions of Latin American powers where the countries themselves worked together, did not include the United States or Canada, but brought in Russia and China and Iran, right? A lot of money from China, Belt and Road Initiative, infrastructure projects, you know, debt traps. They basically enslaved the countries with debt. That all came in, and a lot of the pilot programs were actually done in Venezuela. But what the reason behind this, as publicly stated by Castro and publicly stated by Chavez, and remember, Maduro was handpicked by Chavez, was to push out the United States, to eliminate the Monroe Doctrine. And so actually, I think it's very telling right now that what did Trump just come out and say? What did Pete Hegseth just say? They're going to start restoring the Monroe Doctrine. They're going to begin enforcing it. We're going to start creating friendly nations, and we're going to start overthrowing unfriendly nations. And I think Maduro, you know, in Venezuela, I think he's going to be the first to go as part of this.
That's wonderful. Tell me about this documentary you have coming out, Truth Under Fire.
Oh, yeah. So I just finished a documentary. It's out now on epictv.com, EPOCHTV.com. So I did a documentary about Charlie Kirk. It's called Truth Under Fire, The Framing of Charlie Kirk. And it goes into the hit piece machine. It goes into how the media falsely labeled him as, you know, a bigot and a racist and an anti-Semite and whatever other label they wanted to come up with. How the media used underhanded tricks, framed those narratives, and the infrastructure tied in with it. The advocacy organizations, groups like the ACLU, for example, that label people, define people, and then train government, you know, agencies even, on how to target groups that have that type of label. And how, through the propaganda networks that have, you know, labeled Charlie Kirk like that, it probably led to him being killed. And I think this is a bigger picture than just Charlie Kirk. It's something a lot of conservatives have faced. Death threats, you know, doxing, the whole nine yards. And there's a machine behind it. So this documentary exposes that machine.
How about that? I would encourage everyone, go watch this. We need to remember our martyr and remember how evil the media is. Joshua, I appreciate you, brother. Thank you. Appreciate it. That's fascinating stuff. I'm so much smarter now. I'm going to go tell that to everybody and act like I came up with all of it. I'm going to tell people I came up with Dream Powder from Beam, too. It's not true. Obviously, it's their product, but I love it so much that I'll just take credit for it. You know, you can have a cup of hot chocolate before bed that'll have you sleep like a baby every night. Do you know that? It's delicious. If I didn't tell you there were natural things in it like magnesium and this stuff, you would have no idea. It's just a cup of hot chocolate, cinnamon chocolate, actually. And you'll sleep like a baby. And you'll wake up in the morning feeling good, ready to go, not with that groggy, drugged out, ready to go. Shockbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back. There is some good news out there. Everything doesn't have to be dark and black-pilled. Trump just expanded the travel ban to countries, lovely countries, you know, like Syria. We already have ones on places like Afghanistan, Haiti, Iran, Yemen, but that does raise a very interesting question. I'll ask Charles Cornish Dale that question. He wrote that book, wonderful book, by the way, The Last Men. I would highly encourage you to read that book. Charles, how is the West going to survive without wonderful people coming in from Syria and Afghanistan? I mean, what won't the food get bland?
Well, look, we do have the recipes now, Jesse, so we can actually make the food ourselves.
So,
it's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing, isn't it? I mean, it satisfies common sense that actually, look, these countries, you import people from these countries, and you know, the people you import end up committing heinous acts of terrorism. And I mean, why wouldn't you have a travel ban? I mean, it's obviously controversial. It upsets liberals, but it satisfies the basic tenets of common sense.
Charles, just from a 30,000-foot view, watching Western civilization massively import foreign barbarians over the decades and watching the results of that, why did it happen? Why is it happening? Why are these people, honestly, all over Europe, all over America, why are they so committed to this obvious destruction when it violates common sense?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And, you know, I think about it a lot, and I still am not entirely sure that I've come up with a satisfactory answer. It doesn't satisfy the basic tenets of common sense. It doesn't seem to, you know, if you want to maintain a high-functioning, safe, peaceful, prosperous society, it's the opposite of what you would do. And yet, mass immigration has reached record levels across the Western world. You know, I mean, just okay. So here's an example. Look at what happened in Great Britain under Boris Johnson. So Boris Johnson, Conservative Prime Minister, elected just before the pandemic, massive majority mandate for immigration restriction. This is a man who famously quotes from quotes Homer in ancient Greek. You know, he's a classical scholar. He's a conservative supposedly. And what does he do? He ends up importing a record million plus people a year. In fact, I think during Boris Johnson's tenure, something like 4 million people came to Great Britain. Yeah, it's called the Boris Wave. They actually call it the Boris Wave because it's, you know, so you get a conservative, you elect a conservative government that's promising immigration restriction, and you get 4 million immigrants. And not only that, not immigrants from Europe, as when, you know, Britain was part of the EU, and that was problem enough. People were upset enough about hundreds of thousands of Polish people coming to Britain. But then we leave the EU, and what do you get? You get 4 million people from India, Pakistan, Africa instead, from the third world. So it gets even worse. I mean, I think you have to conclude, basically, that the people in charge simply hate their own citizens. I mean, that's the conclusion I come back to time and time again. These people actively hate the countries and the people they govern and want to destroy them.
Yeah. We've got those on our side of the pond, too. They tell us all the time that America was built by immigrants. What a thing to say to a country of citizens. Charles, by the way, speaking of your side of the pond, did someone go to prison for text messages? What's happening over there?
Yeah, it's not the first either. So yeah, so Joey Barton has been sentenced to prison for sending supposedly offensive messages to a TV personality, to a black TV personality. But this kind of thing happens all the time. I mean, social media is heavily, heavily surveilled now. But not only social media, people's private communications. So there was the really crazy case recently of a woman who was convicted of a hate crime. And I don't think she's been sentenced yet, but she's facing something like 10 years in prison because she referred to a man who sexually assaulted her in a private text message. She referred to the man as a faggot. And she has been convicted of a hate crime and could go to prison for 10 years. So, I mean, it's as bad as people say. It really is. You know, Elon Musk on Twitter is hammering Britain and has been hammering Britain for months and months and months for, you know, this appalling deterioration in terms of civil liberties and freedom. But he's right. And actually, I think a lot of people in Britain are quite grateful to Elon Musk, actually, for really shining a light into all of this murk, because it's only getting worse. I mean, Britain is becoming a very, very sinister, very, very scary place.
Charles, I admit that I haven't had a ton of life experience with Brits. Most of mine came with British Royal Marines when I was in the Marines. And so I have that window, but they were so patriotic. They loved their country. They also drank like fish, but that's another story. They loved their country. Is there a breaking point where people like that rise up and say no more?
Well, I mean, you'd think we'd have reached it many, many times over. Look at the grooming gang scandal, for example. The scale. I mean, the grooming gang scandal actually is an atrocity, basically on a scale that's comparable to a war zone. You know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of white British girls raped, groomed, some even murdered, deliberately targeted by South Asian Muslim men, mainly from Pakistan, because they were white non-Muslims. And, you know, it's the kind of atrocity that you'd actually expect to see somewhere like the Balkans in the 1990s. I mean, it's basically ethnic cleansing is what it is. And actually, as you know, as the full scale of that atrocity has been revealed, there has been huge public anger, without a doubt. I mean, it really is a very live issue. And if you travel around the country, if you go to small towns and cities, you do get the sense that people are very, very... there's a febrile atmosphere. People definitely are worked up. They are really starting to think about, you know, the about what's going on and what can be done. But yes, we absolutely haven't reached our breaking point yet. But it could happen. I won't say it won't, but I am nevertheless surprised. You know, it's been a catalogue of atrocities, and you know, immigration has got so bad, and the economy is bad, and civil liberties are being eroded at such a rate that actually, yes, it does make you wonder what more could happen before people do actually take matters into their own hands.
We've got an issue here in America. I don't know how big it is over there, but we have violent trannies all over this country, people who've been had things injected inside of them, had their body parts chopped off, and now they regularly shoot up schools and try to execute people. We just had a Trantifa group of commies planning on some New Year's terrorism, included a Marine vet, I'm ashamed to say. Charles, you saw this coming a long time ago. Why?
Yeah, I did. So I've been writing about this kind of stuff for quite some time. I mean, I think basically, in basic terms, you have to look at transgender people as kind of prime candidates for radicalization. I mean, they are already the most radicalized left-wing people, basically, in the US for the most part. Most people who are transgender will be of an extremely radical leftist type. But what you have to think, I think, is that, you know, the Trump administration is clamping down on transgenderism in certain respects, clamping down on the gender reassignment surgeries, clamping down on hormonal surgery as well. And that is the way that transgender people reproduce, if you will, in inverted commas. You know, every single group, every single society cares about reproducing itself. And that is how transgender people reproduce, is they get other people to think that they're transgender, they have surgery, they have hormonal therapy, and then they become transgender and the transgender movement grows. So what Trump is really doing by clamping down on that is he really is posing an existential threat to the reproduction of transgenderism as an ideology and more broadly a social movement or grouping. So they do feel, these already radicalized people really do feel that they are under existential assault. And that's why I think these people are increasingly turning violent. And, you know, we've seen a lot of violence already in the first 10 months of the Trump presidency. People forget that in February, a transgender man, Ryan Michael English, I seem to remember his name, tried to assassinate Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and burned down the Heritage Foundation. So that was just a month into the Trump presidency. Then you've got things like the Zizians, this radical transgender vegan cult. They've been murdering people across the US. You know, the man who probably killed Charlie Kirk. He had a transgender boyfriend and a furry obsession. And then it turns out that actually The weirdo who tried to assassinate Donald Trump and very nearly did in Butler last year, he had a furry obsession and also seems to have thought that he was non-binary, that he was transgender as well. So there's a very clear pattern, I think, that's emerging here. And I think it behooves the authorities to take it as seriously as possible. I don't think that this is random. I think that this is very definitely a pattern and they need to pay attention to it because they're going to try and kill more people. They really are.
Gosh, furries. It just makes me feel so old that this stuff even exists. All right, Charles, tell me about The Last Men, because it really is an important read, certainly for men. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so this is my new book. It's just come out. It came out yesterday via Skyhorse. You can get it in hardback, Kindle, and audiobook formats from Amazon in the US. This is my intervention, really, in the ongoing debate about the crisis of masculinity. You know, what is happening to men in the world? Why are men basically, you know, unable to be men anymore? And there's a lot of writing about this. There's people like Jordan Peterson, Senator Josh Hawley has a book, but none of them have really focused on the biological roots. The biological changes that are taking place that are actually making it much harder for men to be men. And in particular, what's happening is we've got this civilizational decline in testosterone levels. Testosterone is the master male hormone. It's responsible for muscle mass, energy, motivation, libido, aggression, other things as well. But it really, testosterone is what makes men men. And we're seeing something like a 1% year-on-year decline in testosterone levels across the Western world, and maybe actually even in the non-Western world as well. And so I'm looking at this problem of masculinity from the perspective of hormones. What is happening to our hormones and why is it happening? And I talk about things like exposure to harmful chemicals, processed foods, sedentary lifestyles, etc. I mean, in many ways, actually, the book is a follow-on from the Tucker Carlson documentary that I was in 2022, which was called The End of Men. And I was in that documentary with RFK Jr., and it was about the crisis of masculinity, biological roots of it, and what people can do about it as well, what men can do to reclaim their masculinity. So this book is a description. It's a diagnosis of the problem, I think a much deeper diagnosis of the problem of masculinity today, but it also contains useful advice that men can follow in order actually to improve their testosterone levels, to improve their health, and to be more masculine.
The book is The Last Men. Go buy it. Charles, thank you, my brother. Appreciate it. Merry Christmas to you. Lighten the mood. Next. All right. It is time to lighten the mood in... It's Christmas time. It's a wonderful, wonderful time of year. And I'll tell you something that I at least attempt to teach my sons. That, remember, Christmas is about giving things, not getting things. My son said the other day, it was last week, something like that, he said, Dad, I think I figured out what I want for Christmas. And I said, have you figured out what you want to give for Christmas? Christmas is about giving things. Give wonderful things to people. And you're sitting here watching, I'm right, you have options. I feel obligated to give you a wonderful Christmas present. So, from us here on I'm Right in the first, Merry Christmas. That's wonderful. I'll see you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.